if you're going to, like, we should have some, there should be some benefit to giving the sermon, and having the door open should be one. Like, don't you think the receptivity of the sermon is going to be higher if people see sunlight? Yeah, that's okay. I don't care about you. I care about everybody else. Anyway, okay. Good morning. For those of you who have given sermons up here over the years, the one thing you can't complain about, you can complain about a lot, the one thing you can't complain about is getting too little warning for the upcoming sermon. Before the dawn of time, Wendell has been drawing up the Trinity speaking schedule, and I think we've talked about all the administrative stuff that he does, but I think it would not surprise me if he moonlights doing administrative stuff for other churches just because he gets such a kick out of lists and scheduling far ahead, which is not how I operate, obviously. and this is terrible AI image creation software. I think it's not Copilot, it's something else. But anyway, I don't pay for it, so that's what you get. It's I don't even remember what the prompt was, but there's a leg sticking out and there's a dismembered hand, and I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. If you look closely, you can see the top. I told the top of the list it's supposed to be sermon schedule 2052, and J.J. Birch's name is at the top of that list. So anyway, so preaching is scheduled so far out by Wendell, and this is where you say, how far out is it scheduled? That I'm not joking. Once I asked what year I would be delivering the message, that's how far out he schedules his sermons. So kingdoms rise, kingdoms fall, children grow old, tectonic plates create new continents, yet your time to exegete Leviticus 3 does not come. And Godot finally arrives, Middle East peace happens, Guy Platter removes all the cardigans from his wardrobe, yet your brilliant sermon on biblical inerrancy remains undelivered and in draft status. In the new regime, however, the Josh regime, I'm finding this delay less of a problem. Just like Jesus pleading ignorance about the date of his second coming, no one at Trinity now knows the day or the hour on which he might give a sermon, not the angels in heaven nor the Son of Man. You could be up here next week. You don't have any idea. So keep a sermon in your back pocket and your powder dry. To that end, I have only today with you. It's not a 30-part series or anything. So just today, and I wanted to revisit a topic that I have addressed a long time ago. In fact, it was 15 years ago up here and about 17 years ago in youth group, and that is the hiddenness and the silence of God, at least God's perceived silence and hiddenness, absence, whatever you want to call it, which is what we'll talk about. And if you're like me, this subject weighs most heavily in times of sorrow, idleness, conflict, pain, or maybe even confusion. Maybe you can think of other reasons why it ebbs and flows in your own life and in your family's life. So you can think of other catalysts as well. But when I last talked about this 15 years ago, God felt more distant, to be frank. And again, I think seasonally, that's just how we are as human beings. Sometimes he feels closer, other times he feels farther away. Now in 2026, I don't feel as I did 15 years ago. But I think, and you probably yourselves find yourselves between those two extremes. Maybe you're at one or the other, somewhere in between. Maybe you're struggling hard with your confidence in the Lord, barely hanging on, or maybe you're resting securely in his promises, fully assured of his character and your relationship to him. But probably everybody is somewhere along that continuum in between the extremes. So regardless of where you are today, I hope you'll find the content this morning helpful. The silence of God is one of those things I suspect many more people grapple with and grapple with mightily than we really know, especially in the church. And even if it's not a difficulty now, it is likely to be at some point in your future and has been at some point in your past. It might be taboo to talk about, or maybe it's maybe not. It's taboo, but just people feel unequipped to talk about it with others. It's one thing to address the topic for yourself to your own satisfaction. It's another thing to aid a brother or sister who is dealing with it. So let's talk about it and explore it this morning. So the problem is not a new one. It's an old one, obviously, if under discussed. Christians have always wished to perceive God more clearly, feel greater security in their status before him, and draw into more intimate fellowship with him. And when I think about the examples of, from the scriptures about this sentiment or the writing that your mind might be drawn to, I think of the Psalms, and apologies for the slides up here. Some of them will be more readable than others. Psalm 22, 1 and 2 says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, so far from my words of groaning? Oh my God, I cry out by day, but you do not answer by night, and am not silent. 42, 3 says, my tears have been food, my food, day and night, while they say to me all the day long, where is your God? And Psalm 88 says, but I cry out to you for help, O Lord. In the morning my prayer comes before you. Why, O Lord, do you reject me and hide your face from me? If you've ever read A Grief Observed, oh gosh, that's so small. Never mind. It'll be hard to read. I'll read it. A Grief Observed by C.S. Lewis in the aftermath of the loss of his wife. He writes, meanwhile, where is God? This is one of the most disquieting symptoms. When you are happy, so happy that you have no sense of needing him, so happy you are tempted to feel his claims upon you as interruption, if you remember yourself and turn to him with gratitude and praise, you will be, or so it feels, welcomed with open arms. But go to him when your need is desperate and all other help is in vain, and what do you find? A door slammed in your face and a sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. After that, silence. You may as well turn away. The longer you wait, the more emphatic the silence will become. There are not lights in the windows. It might be an empty house. Was it ever inhabited? It seemed so once. And that seeming was as strong as this. What can it mean? Why is he so present a commander in our time of prosperity and so very absent in a time of trouble? St. Anselm, in the 11th century, Archbishop of Canterbury, similarly small font, so sorry again, complained, I have never seen thee, O Lord my God, I do not know thy form. What, O most high Lord, shall this man do, an exile far from thee? What shall thy servant do, anxious in his love of thee, and cast out afar from thy face? He pants to see thee, and thy face is too far from him. He longs to come to thee, and thy dwelling place is inaccessible. He is eager to find thee and know thy place, and knows not thy place, sorry. He desires to seek thee and does not know thy face. Lord, thou art my God and thou art my Lord, yet I have never have I seen thee. It is thou that hast made me and hast made me anew and hast bestowed upon me all the blessings I enjoy, and yet I do not know thee. Finally, I was created to see thee, and not yet have I done that for which I was made. If we're honest with ourselves, we'll admit we feel similarly to the psalmists, Lewis and Anselm. Maybe not every day, maybe not with the same intensity, or perhaps more intensity, although I don't know how you can get much more intense than Anselm there. But we can identify with the sentiment nonetheless. My dad at times over the years has said that his relationship with God often feels a bit like a game of hide and seek. But it's not just Christians who dwell and think and write upon this topic. Non-believers demand clear evidence of God's existence and presence to be convinced of Christianity's truth. They wonder how we as Christians can believe in a God who is there, as Schaeffer calls him, when they don't see any smoking gun to prove that he is in fact here, there, or anywhere. The famous atheistic astronomer Carl Sagan in his book Contact mockingly asks why God doesn't place a glowing cross in the sky at night to serve as a testimony to the truth of Christianity. Bertrand Russell, one of Christianity's greatest, most vocal critics of the 20th century, was once asked what he would say to God if he met God on Judgment Day, and God asked him, why didn't you believe in me, Bertrand? Russell said his response would be, "Not enough evidence, God, not enough evidence." Nietzsche, writing in the 19th century, said, "A God who is all-knowing and all-powerful and who does not even make sure his creatures understand his intentions, could that be a God of goodness? Who allows countless doubts and dubieties to persist for thousands of years as though the salvation of mankind were unaffected by them? And who, on the other hand, holds out frightful consequences if any mistake is made as to the nature of truth?" And I think Nietzsche helps us see the crux of the issue here. Given Christianity, the stakes of this life are very high. One's actions will either result in everlasting bliss and companionship with God and forgiveness from him, or else separation from him and torment. That being the case, the Christian longs for greater revelation to assure himself that he is serving a real, worthy being. And the non-Christian desires near coercive amounts of evidence to pull him out of his unbelief. This then is the question for us. Is God actually hidden to an unreasonable degree? If not, how has he revealed himself? And what do we do with our feelings of doubt in the meantime? If so, do we give up belief in him as a result? So we must look at why we doubt, right? Are we grappling with grief? Have we been absent from the word, prayer, or the church? Are we ill or approaching the end of life? Are we in sin? Have we gotten complacent in our wealth, in our security, or in our perceived status? Do we really need God anymore? Well, to answer those questions, let's start off by acknowledging there are plenty of people who think that God's existence and will are sufficiently clear. This applies to Christians and non-Christians as well. That is, there are unbelievers who readily acknowledge the reality of God, but who choose by their own free will to live a life apart from him anyway. And we're not talking about them primarily this morning. Knowing that there are folks who span the whole spectrum of confidence and doubt about this issue should clue us into something very important. Different people have different opinions on what constitutes adequate evidence for God's presence and existence and love. We also have to acknowledge that there's no perfect proof or smoking gun that Christians can produce that will compel all non-Christians to convert and will 100% galvanize a believer's faith. This means that there are ways to lessen the emotional frustration that we might feel as believers of God's seeming absence, but there's no permanent magical formula this side of eternity to resolving that topic of hiddenness. And we all come to this subject with varying demands about how God should show himself to us, as if it were up to us. We all have different personalities, backgrounds, etc., that come to bear on how present we think God should be. In certain cases, the demand of people's hearts is often that God would reveal himself so overwhelmingly that ironclad belief in him is the only possible outcome, a coerced faith, so to speak. So we should step back and ask some questions here. Perhaps God doesn't want mere belief in him. Suppose he wants genuine submission and a relationship with his creatures. Genuine submission from and a genuine relationship with. Perhaps there's value in each individual freely weighing the evidence and deciding what to do with his or her life. Perhaps God has already sufficiently revealed himself and no further revelation is necessary for belief. Maybe a given person's opinion of God's hiddenness wouldn't change no matter how much evidence he or she might be given. We may sometimes feel as if there isn't as much evidence as we would like, but does that mean the evidence that we do have of God's presence is inconclusive? Well, I don't think so. Standards of proof outside of mathematical equations and the rules of logic are pretty tricky. Very few conclusions will be forced upon us in a way like 2 + 2 = 4 is, or the rules of inference and logic. We can and do make important decisions every day on the basis of good but not overwhelming evidence. And when we talk about the evidence for Christianity and the reasons why we suspect and think it's true and believe it's true, we have a whole litany. I won't go through them all this morning, but you can think of all the different arguments from natural theology that we talk about often, the cosmological argument, the moral argument, the teleological argument, the ontological argument, all the different arguments. We have chronicles of the Old and New Testament and Jesus' supernatural works and resurrection from the dead. We have the witness of God's Holy Spirit to us, the moral law written on our hearts, the general revelation in nature. We have the testimony of hundreds of millions of people who claim they've witnessed miracles all over the world. We have so much in terms of objective evidence to lean on. And while none of those arguments or testimonies are coercive, they do serve to show that reasonable people could come to believe in God and rely on God on the basis of them. And they can, for us as believers, beat back doubts in times of turmoil. Years ago, when I was at Grace College, I had as everyone does, have a public speaking class, freshman or sophomore year, and the topic of the speech that I was giving wasn't material insofar as the assignment was just to stick to a particular time frame, which I'm really poor at. And so hopefully not this morning, but in general. And I chose to lay out the facts for the historicity of the resurrection in an eight minute talk, which was a little ambitious. And so I did that, except I ran over by 2 minutes. And again, the whole goal was abide by your 8 minutes, structure your speech properly. And so I left knowing that I would probably not get a great grade on it and was very frustrated. And I walked out of the classroom and was about ready to take off. Grace is out in Warsaw. I was about ready to head home. And this middle-aged man who is in my class came up to me with tears streaming down his face, and I was frustrated. I was angry at myself for not failing, but doing poorly on the assignment. Even in my rambling, rushed cadence, all that sort of stuff, the content and the arguments that had been presented were enough for him to say that he's been waiting to hear something to that effect for years and years, and that he had backslidden, and that he knew the truth of what I was saying and all that sort of stuff. I don't know what he ended up doing with that information, but he was very emotional about it and was thankful for it. And that was after having delivered the message in the most cumbersome way possible. So that should give us when we experience difficulty and trouble in our relationship with God, it might seem cold and uncaring to suggest that we lean upon evidence and arguments and things that we know to be true. But in fact, that is often the best salve. Also, we must not lose sight of objective truths, not just arguments, in the midst of subjective difficulty. Regardless of how we feel, what is true about God does not change. More fundamentally, God does not change as we do. God is ever stalwart as we vacillate between the peaks of happiness and the valleys of frustration. God is patient with us during our uncertainty. In Luke chapter 7, 18 through 28, details John the Baptist's interaction with Jesus from afar. Right, he's in prison. He sends his disciples to see Jesus. And although John had been present for the events of Jesus' baptism and obviously interacted with Jesus and even sat under him in his teaching, he still wasn't quite sure that Jesus was the promised Messiah, right? You'll remember this this questioning from John's disciples to Jesus. Nevertheless, when Jesus is questioned by John's disciples, he says, "Go and tell John what you have seen and heard. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear. The dead are raised up, and the poor have the good news preached to them." Jesus points back to evidence of his works, will, and character. He does not condemn John for the questioning, but rather puts him at ease by reminding him of truths that he already knew. Doubt by itself is not sinful. It is not evil. It does not automatically disqualify you from being a Christian. We must acknowledge that the proof texts that are often cited when talking about this topic, 2 Corinthians 5:7, James 1:6, Matthew 21:21, just don't dispel this notion. God wants our trust in him to increase. He does not rebuke us for thinking critically about our relationship to him. An uncertainty regarding God by itself is neutral. As Honest Guinness says, Doubt can have deep integrity, but it can also be lazy and dishonest. In our search and longing for God, let our doubts spur us on to a fruitful relationship with him and not serve as an excuse to navel gaze. Next, we cannot underestimate the fact that we're free-willed beings who have a sinful nature. We can talk ourselves in and out of just about anything if we have the right motivation. All the evidence in the world doesn't matter if we don't want to entertain where the evidence leads. We must consider that sin, faulty assumptions about God, and our own selfish desires often obscure our vision of God in this life. If that's true, the onus is on us to change our behavior than on God to show himself more clearly. The problem may not be, and probably isn't, the evidence or the lack of evidence or the perceived lack of evidence. The problem may be our disposition towards the evidence. Consider Jesus' parable of the rich man and Lazarus in Luke 16:19-31. I'm not going to read the first two-thirds of the parable because you already you know the story. Lazarus, a beggar, is outside of a rich man's house. A rich man pays him no heed. Eventually, they both die. Lazarus goes to Abraham's bosom in the afterlife. The rich man goes to hell, and there is a dialogue between the rich man basically begging Abraham to have Lazarus cool him, and he says, "We can't do that." And then this dialogue follows. The rich man answers, "Then I beg you, Father, send Lazarus to my father's house, for I have five brothers. Let him warn them, so that they will not also come to this place of torment." Abraham replied, "They have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them." "No, Father Abraham," he said, "but if someone from the dead goes to them, they will repent." He said to him, "If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced even if someone rises from the dead." Our intellectual, emotional, and spiritual condition is often the primary factor in how distant or close God might seem. More evidence is not usually the solution in wavering Christian commitment, if you can believe it. At times when maximal evidence for God's existence and will, like miracles, for instance, were produced in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, you'll recall that it was often met with a refusal to trust God. We should not think that the supernatural works of God always produce conversion or an increased awareness or love for God. Very often, they do not. Next, God requires us to actively seek him. Despite the fact that God alone has done the meaningful work in securing his people's salvation, the scriptures tell us that it will take earnest effort to come to a knowledge of God. But this implies that there is positive evidence to investigate and that the evidence isn't indisputable or overwhelming. God does not force himself into our lives. In fact, he tells us that he lays out markers of his presence everywhere in this world and then bids us find them and follow them, Acts 17. His promise is that our genuine and purposed inquiries about him will be rewarded, and he has rewarded us. The Bible informs us that if a given person would respond positively to God in certain circumstances, then it seems that God ensures that those circumstances come about in the life of that person. God is not willing that any should perish, 2 Peter tells us, and will afford the appropriate evidence for each person. Jeremiah 29:13. "You will seek me and you will find me when you search for me with all your heart." Matthew 7:7, "Ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be open." And when we talk about this topic, maybe your minds went to Blaise Pascal because, of course, he has a lot to say on it. I'll only give a quote or two, but many good things to say. He says, "Willing to appear openly to those who seek him with all their heart and to be hidden from those who flee from him with all their heart, God so regulates the knowledge of himself that he has given indications of himself which are visible to those who seek him and not to those who do not seek him. There is enough light for those to see who only desire to see and enough obscurity for those who have a contrary disposition." A true search requires hard work. The fervency of a search will be directly proportional to the importance of the item that is lost. If I lose my sock, my search for it will be brief and uninvolved. If I lose my car keys, I'll look harder and I'll look for longer, and I might ask Janelle for help in finding them. If I lose Christian, it's really going to depend on how many times he's ripped off his diaper and pooped on the floor that day. But you get the point. The fervency of a search will be directly proportional to the importance of the item that is lost. With what intensity, then, should we pursue a relationship with God, especially when he seems absent? It goes without saying that nothing else in life matters in comparison to such a search. We should press on, even when we're beset by tremendous doubt and angst. In Philippians, Paul says that he counts everything else as a loss and as trash, as rubbish, that he might know Christ. That is the correct degree of fervency. If God seems absent, we should search him out with every ounce of grit and determination we have for as long as it takes. And why would we suppose that anything other than a lifetime of inquiry and searching would be sufficient to settle the ultimate question of existence? If we're willing to give up on the search for God short of death, we can safely say we weren't serious enough about it in the first place. There is a reason that Paul often compared the life of the Christian to a race. It's exhausting, and the very real temptation to give up exists. Further, why do we expect answers about God to be given to us without any effort? No other knowledge comes about in such a way. If I want understanding, comprehensive understanding, ironclad understanding on a topic, I have to study it through and through. I have to be consumed by it. I meditate upon it day and night. We cannot demand that God show himself to us in a miraculous way when we neglect how he has already spoken to us. You'll recall from the Gospels that the Pharisees often demanded that Jesus produce some sort of sign or wonder or miracle. Jesus did not give in to their wishes because what was he after? He knew that such things like miracles in those specific instances wouldn't move the needle of trust or belief from that group, those groups. We are not entitled to more evidence. God may provide it, but we cannot demand it. In fact, gratitude for and dwelling in the ways in which God has already spoken is often the first step in feeling more secure in him. And a great place to start is looking what God has already revealed. And as Hebrews 1 says, in the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets and at many times and in various ways, but in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son. So next, despite our discontent, God's revelation of himself to us may be sufficient for his purposes. Again, Pascal has some good insight here. He says, the prophecies, the very miracles and proofs of our religion, are not of such a nature that they can be said to be absolutely convincing, but they are also of such a kind that it cannot be said that they are unreasonable. It is unreasonable to believe them. Perhaps God knew that if the evidence was greater than it currently is, the world would be chafed and desensitized. Even a glowing cross in the sky would eventually be ignored. Familiarity, regardless of the subject, breeds contempt. Think of how absolutely remarkable the Statue of Liberty must have been to New Yorkers in 1886 versus how commonplace and mundane it seems to them now, by contrast. Gary Habermas, many of you will have read him on the topic of the historicity of the resurrection. He writes a lot on this topic of emotional doubt. He relays a long time ago, when he was an atheist and a young man, he's wrestling with his thoughts about God. One evening, he picked out a particular tree in his backyard through the window, and he promised God that if that specific tree was knocked over in the morning, he would give his life to Christ. To Habermas's astonishment, the next morning, the tree was flat on the ground. No other trees around it had been disturbed. So he became a Christian, right? He did not. He asked God to do a miracle, but he did not respond with anything other than bemusement when his request was fulfilled. So God is not interested in fame or notoriety. He is interested in love for and worship from each person that he's created. We must not make the mistake of thinking that God simply wants people to acknowledge him. Doing so would be a necessary but not sufficient condition for achieving his purposes. Mere intellectual agreement with the proposition God exists isn't worth much. As James 2:19 says, a passage you all know, you believe that there is one God, good, even the demons believe that and shudder. It's safe to say that God cares deeply about whether we have a genuine reconciled relationship with him, not that we merely agree that he exists. In John 10:10, Jesus says, I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. So, in conclusion, what can we say about all this? My inability to split quotes up into multiple slides is crazy. So, Habermas has a good practical piece of advice here, and I know you can't read that because it's just minuscule, but I'll read it. He says, hundreds of recent psychological studies have proven that, contrary to what we often think, our chief pain in life comes not from what happens or does not happen to us. Rather, our worst pain generally occurs from what we tell ourselves about the things that we experience. In other words, how do we download and interpret life is of the utmost importance. It follows in regards to God's silence that much of our worst pain is self-inflicted. Most likely it is derived precisely from not from anything that God fails to do, but from telling ourselves things like the following. God does not care about me, refuses to act, breaks his promises, or does things for others but not for me. Thinking and voicing such misbeliefs are the lies that can poison our lives and serve as the direct cause of our most painful emotions. Therefore, exchanging these lies for truth can help align our thinking with reality and dramatically reverse the patterns of self-inflicted pain. In other words, follow Paul's direction to the Philippians when he tells them to dwell upon the things that are true, noble, right, lovely, admirable, excellent, and praiseworthy. In that vein, we are to tell ourselves and others the truth and then ruminate on that truth. Allow trusted Christian brothers and sisters to pull you out of the pit of doubt rather than wallowing in your misery or pulling them down in with you. Next, we need to be in the spiritual disciplines and habits that we know deep down we often neglect. And I say this mostly to myself. Staying in the Word, praying diligently, communing with other Christians in church, Hebrews 10:25, and so on, keep us tethered to Jesus, to the character, the person, the will of Jesus. The more we neglect these things, the more distant God is going to feel. If we separate ourselves from the locus of all goodness, wisdom, power, and so forth, we're going to feel those things less and less. As Oz Guinness writes, the inescapable presence of doubt is a constant reminder of... The inescapable presence of doubt is a constant reminder of our responsibility to truth. The reason we entertain doubt seriously is because we think of truth seriously. Creeping uncertainty about God is the noisy alarm that sounds when there may be a possibility of falling into error or sending our lives in a direction we ought not. It lets us know that we have a duty to truth and that all will not be well until we find that truth. As St. Anselm has said, ours is a faith that seeks understanding. To conclude the conclusion this morning, let's look ahead by looking back. Aside from the alienation from God that Adam and Eve's sin brought about, the what we call epistemic distance between us and God is the chief culprit in him feeling distant. This veil, this opacity, this wall that exists between our Creator and us is, of course, our own doing. We got ourselves kicked out of paradise. We cannot perceive God clearly, but as we have seen, he is there. God, it must be said, knows and loves us perfectly, even though we cannot return that favor. We must look forward to a return to intimacy with God in the new heavens and the new earth. When we are redeemed and resurrected, we will be communing with God in an even richer way than Adam and Eve did in the Garden of Eden. We won't long for God or waver in unbelief because, of course, the Lord will be clear and present with us. Before that time, certainty about one's own salvation status and other related topics of insecurity, we must note that those are not center circle issues. The core doctrines of the faith that we talk about so many times in this church are the center circle issues, but assurance of our salvation status and other things related to doubt are not. So right now, our consolation concerning separation from God is this. We are not alone in our angst. No one is alone. This is a universal human experience to one degree or another. Also, and more importantly, Jesus came to earth and experienced firsthand the longing and hiddenness, or longing that God's hiddenness begets. The most explicit manifestation of God to man himself endured separation from his Father and eventually the Father's silence on the cross. As a human, Jesus depended upon the scriptures, prayer, communing with those made in his image, and so forth. His cry on Golgotha of, my God, why have you forsaken me, brings us full circle to where we started in Psalm 22:1. We most definitely have, as Hebrews 4:15 tells us, a high priest who is able to sympathize with our weaknesses. Lastly, we will know the Lord in the most complete way possible one day soon. That deep desire that we have now to see him and to be with him will be rewarded, and our doubts and tears and heartache and all those related things will be done away with. We will be in awe of who God truly is and will rest well knowing that the struggle and the wait were worth it. And I think I put this, this last verse, set of verses. 1 Corinthians 13:12 will serve as our concluding remarks for today and our hope for the age to come. Now we see but a poor reflection as in a mirror, then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known.